Bear with me for a second.
I cannot handle that. I know in theory, the chances of some horrible person coming and attacking me from behind when the door is closed is not really all that different from the same when the door is open, but still, it's unsettling. A couple weeks ago, we were talking about the need for not just reading our Bible, but reading for with a purpose, reading with an end in mind. We were talking about examples. And I had intended to do this last week, and I wasn't quite ready for it, and it was singing night, so I decided to just put it off for a second. So I want to talk a little bit here today about history, and about our tendency to repeat it. As you know, many of you would not recognize the name George Santayana, but you would recognize his quote, where he said that those who refuse to learn from history are destined to repeat it. Well, there's a lot of truth to that. And especially as you read the Bible, as you see one generation after another, people who are claiming to be the people of God, and in many instances trying to be the people of God, and falling into the same traps and making the same mistakes. And we read, especially as we're reading this year, in a relatively quick fashion, you read over just one story after another, and you're just astonished, if you read like I am, that we keep seeing the same stories. In fact, oftentimes almost exactly the same stories that are told from one generation to another, and you wonder why in the world these people won't learn. And the answer is for the same reason that we're not learning. Because we think of history as being something that happened to other people in other times, not necessarily all that relevant to what's going on in our life, not necessarily something that is important or interesting. If you polled the population, what's your least favorite school subject? I'm sure history would rank pretty high on that list. And this is why. We're just not all that interested. It doesn't seem very relevant. And I understand that. I like history, personally. A lot of other people do, too. But if you don't see yourself as part of history, if you don't see these stories as being your own stories, then it becomes just kind of a bunch of stuff that happened to other people who have been dead for 1,000 years. And maybe there's not all that much interesting about that. I understand that. What we need to do, though, when we're reading history, is read it with a view of seeing ourselves in that story. Am I like David? Am I like Bathsheba? Am I like Ahab? Am I like Elijah? Am I like Cain or Abel? Which one of these can I relate to? Which one of these is speaking to me in this moment? And not be afraid to see a negative lesson in there. Not be afraid to say, you know what? This guy is doing kind of like what I'm doing, and with the same kind of attitude as me, and he got struck dead by God. Maybe I'm on the wrong path. Maybe I need to do a little bit better than I've been doing in the past. At any rate, a few more words about how we can learn from history here this evening. And the first lesson is this, and I'm not suggesting these are the only lessons you might learn, but these are a few. The first one is that adversity is common. It is not unusual at all. And this is an important lesson because it's a very difficult lesson for us to grasp. Because we're not especially interested in other people's problems, right? We're interested in our problems, and we're certainly not interested in the problems of people who lived 1,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago. I mean, what difference could that possibly make in my life? I'm having trouble paying my bills. I'm having trouble with rebellious children. I'm having trouble with unsympathetic parents or whatever it is that you happen to be struggling with at any given time. It's very easy when we separate ourselves from the historical narrative to imagine that we are, in fact, the people who invented problems. That it's all about me. And I sometimes talk about how big our world is and how our world tends to expand. Hopefully, at least, it expands as we grow bigger. When you are, you know, 6 months old, you care about whether you have food or don't have food. You care about whether your diaper is clean or not clean. And that's more or less it. That's your entire world. And those two things are of enormous importance, and nothing else matters at all. And that's okay if you're 6 months old. But as you get a little bit bigger, as you go to kindergarten, for instance, you start interacting with other kids, you realize that they have needs also. They're not as important as your needs, but they do have needs. There's other lives out there. They have other experiences than yours. And gradually, your world starts getting bigger. And eventually, hopefully, we get to the point where we can actually empathize with other people and sympathize with other people, take ourselves out of our own position and project onto somebody else. and see things from their perspective and learn from their life. And we realize, hopefully, that other people in fact do have problems, and they may even be bigger than our own problems. When we are Christians, when we look at the Bible story, we look at the story of people who have suffered for the cause in times past, surely no other lesson can be so obvious, so glaringly obvious as this one, that godly people will, from time to time, suffer persecution. Godly people will struggle because of their faith, sometimes specifically because of their faith. Holiness, for instance, is always going to be ridiculed, not by everybody, of course, and hopefully not by the people of God, hopefully not by our brethren. But this is not an unusual thing for us to be living holy, righteous, God-centered lives, and people look at us and think we're crazy. It makes perfect sense when we're here in this building on a nice Sunday like this. But as we read from 1 Peter chapter 4, just a few moments ago, in verse number 1, when people of the world see this, it's going to seem like the craziest thing in the world. You're doing all of these things that seem to be absolutely pointless, and you're deliberately avoiding everything in the world that I enjoy. You know, who in the world would do something like that? Of course we're going to get ridiculed for that. The thing is, holiness has always existed. Ungodliness has always existed. It's not necessarily strange, then, when we stand out from the crowd. It's supposed to look like this. And so, therefore, it's not unusual when we see this opposition. If you don't look at the historical record, if you think that you are the first one who's ever suffered for his faith or her faith, it might be the case that you consider this to be an unwinnable war. It may seem completely unreasonable. And I can get that. If I'm the only one who's ever gone through this, who's to say whether it's reasonable or not? In reality, of course, we are simply the latest page in a very, very, very long book. And there will be other pages after us if Jesus cares. Revelation chapter 13. I'm not going to take you through the entire chapter, but I refer to this from time to time as being basically a microcosm of what our life is here on earth. Whether John had specific reference in his vision to a particular beast here or a particular beast there, I don't know. But I think the main point for us, especially 2,000 years later, is that we see forces beyond our comprehension deliberately at war with us, trying to put us in a position where we'll compromise our faith. One of them may look like the beast out of the sea. This tremendously powerful thing that just scares and intimidates people and threatens them. Basically, you are going to bow the knee to the beast, you're going to pinch incense to the emperor, or whatever the form may take. You're going to do this or else. And the or else is so terrifying that we think, well, I guess we just have to do that. Or it may look like the beast out of the earth, the false prophet, as he's sometimes called. The one who says, well, here, look, wink, wink. Now, let's just kind of go along with this for a while. We'll just kind of fake it. He looks kind of like Jesus. He's kind of like the Lamb. This is a message that resembles the gospel in many ways. Maybe this is good enough. Maybe I can do this and kind of compromise a little bit and get by. Again, if we were the first ones to ever have this battle, those two threats, those two paths for us to take, they may look very interesting to us. Now, when we look at a Bible history that is just littered with people who took the one path and people who took the other path and were condemned by God and suffered eternally for it, then maybe we'll be a little less likely to take those paths and we'll be more inclined to stay on the straight and narrow, as it were, instead of that. God's message is always rejected. This really struck me when we were reading through the prophets this year, how it is that one after another, after one prophet after another is told, essentially, you go out there and preach to a bunch of knuckleheads, a bunch of people who don't look like they have any interest at all in spiritual things, and you go out there and preach to them for a few years, and you find out that, in fact, they don't have any interest in spiritual things, and the problem may, in fact, get worse instead of getting better, and you yourself are just going to suffer tremendously for it. But you go out and do it anyway. Well, why would I want to do that? Again, if I'm the first person to ever have a door slammed in my face, maybe I wouldn't do that. Yeah, maybe I'm just not suited for this. Maybe it's all about me. After all, I'm inclined to think it's all about me anyway, right? Well, come to find out it's not about me. It's about God. It's about God's message. And God's message and God's messengers have always gotten doors slammed in their face. Such is the case by the wicked world. Those who are not inclined to listen in general to spiritual messages. Jesus praises God, in fact, that this is the case in his day. That praise you, God. Verse number 25 and 26 of Matthew chapter 11. That you hid these things from the wise and understanding of this world and revealed them to the babes. There are certain people who are just too smart for the gospel in their own mind. They're too dependent on themselves, too confident in themselves. They're just not interested by that. And especially they're not interested because they listen to it for 5 minutes and realize they're not only are they not going to be able to be pat on the head for how wonderful they are, they're in fact going to have to quit a lot of things they really, really love doing. Well, I'm not interested in that. And so they'll leave. Such has always been the case. And the same thing is true for those who would seem on the surface to be inclined to listen to the word, but oftentimes let us down. And you don't want to hear a bunch of sob stories from preachers here, but the fact is, much of my time over the last 30 years or so has been spent beating my head against one wall or another, trying to convince people who claim to love the Lord, who claim to be interested in spiritual things, who claim to want to be going to heaven, to do very basic, fundamental spiritual things that clearly are connected to God's things, to God's plan through the Word, and yet are not interested in that. Why is that? I don't know. I wish I did. All I can do is continue to do the work, and I'm sure many of you have similar experiences with family members or loved ones or whatever. Paul refers to his Jewish brethren, his brethren after the flesh, in Romans chapter 10 and really back to chapter 9 also, and emphasizing how this pattern of behavior is manifesting itself, and it's not especially unusual. You have a long track record of people in the Old Testament who listened to Isaiah, who listened to Jeremiah, who listened to Moses, listened or didn't, if you prefer. This is the prophecy of the people of God, verse 21, at the end of Romans chapter 10. As for Israel, he says, all the day long I have stretched out my hands to a disobedient and obstinate people. They're quoting from Isaiah chapter 65. How is it that such can be the case? I don't know exactly, but it has always been the case. And so therefore, it's not so much that my sermon wasn't especially effective or that your tactic was maybe not the best one to employ. It's because people have rejected God's word consistently over the years. It's about them, not about us, at least primarily. We are the heirs to an ancient legacy. This has always been the way God's people have behaved and always the way that they have been treated. We should consider ourselves to be blessed in this company. That's what Jesus says, blessed are you who suffer for righteousness' sake. There's the kingdom of heaven, he says. When men revile you and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake, rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for your reward in heaven is great, the text says. For so persecuted the prophets who were before you. Again, going back to the Old Testament, this is how they've always treated righteous people. This is how they've always treated people who are trying to help others on the road to heaven. So they're going to treat you the same way. That's not surprising at all. Shouldn't be surprising at all. Second point. History teaches that prosperity is poison. And this is a tough one because we all want to prosper. And I'm talking about me too. Rare is it that I, am handed a dollar bill that I don't put it in my pocket. At least temporarily. I may spend it some other time. I joke all the time. I don't do this job for the money, but I do cash the checks. That's and I'm not apologizing for that. There's nothing wrong with that. And we would all like to have an extra digit on our paycheck. There's nothing wrong with that either. Here's the problem. The problem is that we don't tend to do very well when we get that extra money. And when I say we, I'm not talking about we here in Pensacola in 2019. I'm talking about we humans. And such is the case even for godly people who ought to know better. There is a very strong tendency toward rebellion, selfishness, greed, and all kinds of things that are connected to the love of money if we find ourselves suddenly affluent. We have a great deal of difficulty. The love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, the text says in the New American Standard Bible. in 1 Timothy, chapter 6 and verse 10. All kinds. Lots of different things. Bad things that has happened. Doesn't have to. Doesn't always do it. But there's a very strong historical connection between prosperity and sin. You find a betrayal of God's people, for instance. Sometimes you will be it. You have a certain degree of authority, a certain degree of influence, sway over people. And because you have this weakness, because you have this carnal desire, bad things happen. You cause bad things to happen to other people. It's called the way of Balaam in 2 Peter, chapter 2, verse 15. Forsaking the right way, they've gone astray, having followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. For he received a rebuke for his own transgression, for a mute donkey, speaking with the voice of a man, restrained the madness of the prophet. That's an interesting story. If you haven't read that lately, I'd encourage you to go back and read Numbers 22 through 24. And remind yourself of how Balaam, because he loved money, because he wanted the big paycheck, was willing to put himself time and time again in a position where he could do the wrong thing. Now, as it happened, inspiration kept him, by and large, from doing the wrong thing. God saved him from himself. But eventually, he escaped those shackles and found a way to, in fact, curse God's people by allowing them to curse themselves. The disaster that we see in Numbers chapter 25 evidently was Balaam's doing. He came up with this plan. And it's because he loved money. And how many times do we find ourselves in that same kind of predicament? That we can do what, and preachers are the worst at this, that at least they're in the best position to do this. Because they love money, because they want to see that money coming in, they will preach the things that will ensure their own survival, their own paycheck, rather than doing the things that are in accordance with God's will. It all comes back to the love of money. Betraying Jesus himself. You remember the Judas story, of course, in Luke chapter 22, verse 3 and following. Luke's account says specifically that the devil came into Judas's heart. A rather picturesque way of describing this betrayal. And it's not involuntarily. You know, Judas wasn't a passive participant in all of this. Judas allowed this to happen because he loved money. And because of that, he betrayed Jesus, his best friend, his mentor. How could somebody do something like that? Well, this is how. And this is how it has always been. This is the tendency that we suffer with even today. The more we get, the more we tend to love what we get. There does not have to be a connection there. And usually that's when we just kind of wipe our brow and, oh, that was close. I was afraid that the preacher was going to get there and saying making more money was a sin, and therefore I can't make more money. But no, he's not saying that. It's not a sin to make more money. Good. And then they go out and make as much money as they possibly can and ignore the rest of the sermon. I don't want you to do that. That's not the main point. It is true that you can make money and stay faithful to God. No question about that. Many people have done it. Many people continue to do it. But it doesn't always work that way. And it's fair to say it doesn't usually happen that way. The comfort that we find in this life oftentimes tends to lead to complacency. The ivory couches that Amos talks about in chapter 6 and verses 4 and following, this level of comfort that was available even in that day. Millennia ago, before the internet, before whatever the cool Xboxes or whatever it is the kids are getting these days, before any of that, people were still in position to put themselves in a more luxurious place, and they were willing to pay to do it. And when they did it, they became addicted, and they became dependent on such things, and very hesitant to do anything in their life that would rob them of their culture. Of their comforts that they had become acquainted with. It's about where we place our treasure, ultimately. We're supposed to be storing up for ourselves treasures in heaven. And it's very easy to say, it's relatively difficult for us to do. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 21 says, "Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." If we will invest ourselves heavily in spiritual things, then we can find ourselves reaping a spiritual reward. If, on the other hand, all of our treasure is tied up in our retirement plan, or in our big house, or in our great vacation, or whatever it happens, if that's where we're spending all of our money, it's an indication of where our heart is. And if that place is not in a spiritual arena, that may be a reflection on our values, which may sound like you're having to spend 50.1% of your income on spiritual things. That's not my point. I don't know what the magic number is. But surely we can all acknowledge that playing this game, trying to balance spiritual and carnal responsibilities, carnal and spiritual values, is a very dangerous precedent for us to set. We tend very strongly, oftentimes, to drift over into the wrong direction. Every generation thinks it's going to be the exception. Every generation thinks that it is going to be the one who masters this task. We get to have our cake and eat it too. It's not a sin to have cake, and it's not a sin to eat cake. And so therefore, we're going to figure it out. We're going to crack the code. We've got thousands and thousands of years of history saying no. But we're smarter than they were. We got it going on. We'll be able to work this out. We can pursue carnal things as much as we possibly can and still serve God. No one has ever been able to do that. And we are no exception to that. That's the lesson that history is trying to teach us, if we will listen to it. If we are servants of God, if we supposedly are putting Him first, what we need to be doing is pursuing that. Looking for ways to serve, to wash one another's feet, as Jesus did, and as Jesus required us to do in John 13 and verse 14. This is our calling. This is our task. Not a carnal thing, but a spiritual thing. This is what we pursue. Now, when you do that, you're going to find that foot washing is going to run contrary to your own personal and financial interests. It's going to cost you something, is what I'm saying. Well, what are you going to do in a situation like that? Are you going to pursue God's things, or are you going to pursue your own things? We have to find a way to move past this. Think about other people instead of just ourselves. See, that's the thing about these carnal goals we're talking about. We can talk a good game about, wouldn't it be great if I had $1 million? If I had $1 million, I could help so many people. Well, maybe you could, and maybe you would. But what would be the first thing that you do? If I were to just separate from this sermon, if I just walked up to you on the street, hey, I got $1 million for here, what's the first thing you're going to do? Is all fine and good to tell a preacher, well, I would give 10% of it to the Lord's church. That's what I would do. Okay, that's good. Or I would find some homeless person and pay for his bills for life. Or I would donate to some tremendous charity or whatever. But if we call on an honest moment, what would you say? I'm going to Disney World. Or whatever it happens to be. I'm throwing a party for myself. I'm going to really, really indulge. And then with the $400,000 or $500,000 I have left, then we can talk about something else. Well, and I don't want to tell you how to manage your money. I'm not getting into that. But when our knee-jerk reaction is to take care of ourselves, and after having done that, find new ways to take care of ourselves, we're not following the pattern that Jesus has given to us. We are following the pattern that the world has given to us. And that may be something that we need to look at. We're supposed to think of not our own interests, but the interests of others, the text says in Philippians 2, verses 3 and 4. Thinking of others instead of just thinking of ourselves. That is the obligation that is placed on us. If we don't have the love of money, that's not such a big deal. We can do that without the love of money. If we do have the love of money, it's going to wind up being a tremendously difficult ordeal. I'll give you one other point. Deliverance is certain. And this is we want to end on a positive note here. The Bible teaches us over and over and over again. If you will stay true to His calling, if you will do the right thing, if you wake up every day and serve God to the best of your ability, learn from your mistakes, move forward, try to improve, ask for His forgiveness when you mess up. When you do this, God will take care of you. This has always been the case for the people of God. If there's any lesson from history, please learn this one. God promises that there is, in fact, a future for His people, that God will provide for them in some fashion. Egypt is a wonderful metaphor that's given to us in the Old Testament. Well, it wasn't a metaphor for the people in Moses' day. It was a reality. It was slavery back then. And it's difficult while we're living in Egypt for us to see some kind of future. But God says there is. In fact, God told them before they ever went into Egypt that there was going to be a future. He told Abraham, your people are going to serve others for 400 years, but then they're going to come back. That promise is given, and that promise may have been forgotten. 400 years is a long time. But we have the assurance that however long it is that we wait in Egypt, God sees us. He sees our affliction, as he saw the affliction of Israel of old. In Exodus chapter 3, verse 7 and 8, I have heard their cries. And he is going to step in and take care of things in his time, in his way. That is the assurance that is given to us. It will happen. So when we are going through the difficulties of life, the short-term difficulties, all those who live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. Paul tells Timothy in chapter 4, 1 Timothy verse number 12. While this is happening, we need to, again, back up and see ourselves in the bigger picture. It's not just that we're getting picked on. It's that we are part of this global and timeless battle that the people of God will always, always win. May take a little time. May take some faith. It will take some faith. But God promises that there is a future. And there's a future in the luxury of Babylon as well. I like how Babylon is used as a metaphor, as a symbol, basically, for carnality and ugliness and all that the ugly, sinful world has to offer. In Revelation chapter 17, verse 5. Babylon the Great. This is who she is. She's everything that's ugly, everything that's carnal, everything that's sinful, in all of her glory. We are living in Babylon now, right? We find ourselves like Israel by the rivers of Babylon, the text says in Psalm 137. And people keep coming up to us asking us to sing songs. Tell me how great it is to be a Christian. I don't feel like telling you how great it is to be a Christian. I'm miserable here. Everything that I see is a violation of what I stand for. Everything that I see is an affront to decency and godliness. I don't want to be here anymore. But we find songs to sing anyway. Because God is with us. And because we will not stay in Babylon forever. We will in fact be delivered in God's way. This is going to take faith though. We have to trust that he is capable of saving us. Because you're going to wake up tomorrow to, by and large, the same world you woke up to today. The world's not going to change very much in 24 hours. And the day after, it's probably not going to change much then either. The fundamentals of this world are never going to change. There's always going to be a lot of bad people out there doing bad things. Sometimes doing the bad things to you. We can and we will win in all of this. Jesus promises to save us from our sins. That's why he gave us the gospel. It is the power of God to salvation to everyone who believes. And you believe. And so therefore, no matter what's going on in the world, you're saved from your sins. The gospel promises that. As long as you walk in the light as he is in the light. 1 John 1 verse 7. You have this assurance, this promise from God. Not from me, not from the elders, from God. That you will in fact be okay. That God will take care of you. Power to save from our tormentors. The people who are picking on you. The people who are trying to diminish or even eliminate your faith. Some of them from a political perspective, some of them from a moral perspective, entertainment, whatever it happens to be. There are souls who were exactly where you are right now, that are before the throne of God, before the altar. The text says in Revelation 6 and verse number 9, and they're frustrated too. How long, O Lord, Master and True, will you not judge and avenge those who are on the earth? How long is this going to take? And the answer oftentimes comes out a lot longer than you'd like. But it will happen. He promises. He promises them and he promises us that there is, in fact, a light at the end of this story. That there is going to be repentance, or there is going to be salvation and deliverance. The bad people will get what's coming to them in God's way. And we will get what's coming to us because we are partakers of grace. And even saving us from ourselves, which is oftentimes the biggest battle of all. I'll refer you to Deuteronomy chapter 8 real briefly before we close up here. Deuteronomy 8, and I'll read from verse number 11 and following. Moses here trying to get one more word in with people, trying to encourage them one more time to do what's right as they are preparing to enter into the land of Canaan. Beware, Moses says, that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his ordinances and his statutes, which I am commanding you today. Otherwise, when you have eaten and are satisfied, and you've built good houses and lived in them, And when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and gold multiply and all that you have multiplies, then your heart will become proud and you'll forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That is our challenge. Because, you know, we here in America, and we like to fuss about this sometimes, but we're doing pretty well. We are living comfortable lives, most of us. And if our internet is not as quick as it could be, we think the world's coming to the end. You know, or if we don't get to spend the big bucks on the vacation, or if we have to buy, you know, secondhand clothes, or whatever it happens to be, we think, oh, we're just so afflicted in this lower middle income level that we've found ourselves in. We are more than abundantly blessed. And the fact that we're fussing about these kind of things is an indication of where maybe our heart is. We have to have confidence that God is planning better things for us. And if we will go in the path that he has charted out for us, if we will go in his direction, then he can conquer these things, that we can purify our hearts, we can purify our minds, we can be better servants of his. Sometimes the toughest thing in the world is to have confidence in ourselves, that we can in fact grow, that we can get better at what we're trying to do. But God will help us. Jesus will help us. This is a battle that can be won. The Bible is littered with examples of people who meant to do well, who were trying to do well, and did awful, awful things, and are yet counted among the faithful because their heart was with God, and God is righteous and just to punish sin, but he is also loving and merciful and willing to forgive sin if we will give ourselves to him. These are the messages that we need to be seeing in the Bible. I hope that, you know, when we're talking about third graders, you know, and telling stories about Daniel in the lion's den, or talking about parting the Red Sea, or whatever it happens to be. These are really interesting stories, and hopefully they're colorful, and they're majestic, and they grab people's attention, and the kids are just sitting on tenter hooks, and, oh, this is just fascinating. And we think if we have distracted them successfully for 45 minutes, then we've done the work. We've done good. We taught Bible to the kids because we taught them all this history. And that's great. But we as adults, hopefully we get to the point where we realize it's not just a collection of stories. This is not just a lot of stuff that happened to a lot of other people a long, long time ago. This is about you and me. This is about our efforts, our successful and sometimes our not so successful efforts to please God, to honor him. And if the challenges and difficulties that face people of old are ours, then certainly the hope is ours too. That God can and will do wonderful things with us if we'll let him. If we will learn the lessons from history and go in the direction God would have us to go in. And that's the lesson for the evening. And I apologize for my physical state. I'm working on this. But at any rate, we're going to offer an invitation to those who need to respond to it. If there's something that is amiss in your life of a spiritual nature, if you're not walking with Christ as perfectly as you would like, and if you need help from brothers and sisters in Christ, if you need to be baptized in water for remission of sins, whatever your need happens to be of a spiritual nature, please allow us to respond while we ask you to respond to the invitation at this time as we stand.